Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the aspartame update right after this. You know, back in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10, where it says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Well, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. It's public business that is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper are things like stocks and bonds and Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and clad coin or currency. And you know that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper. And there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper versus gold and silver. You know, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good reason. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for you and I to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933 when they did it, that in order to subjugate a free people, you would first have to take away their gold and silver coin so that you could abolish the people's right to property and to destroy their property rights thereby. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and our property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me show you how to do just that. That's in our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult homeschool. Now, if you'd like more information about my private business school, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's informative, and it's entertaining. It's educational, and it's free. So you can call and order one right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study, and if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click on to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. O-R-G, and go to our archives page. Aspartame. Aspartame is an artificial sweetener. It was approved by the Food and Drug Administration for general use back in 1981. It's been the subject of controversy from that day to this. There are do-gooders out there that are trying to get you to stop using aspartame because it's bad for your health. And then there are the food industries, you know, it's the big companies, the big multinationals like Coca-Cola and PepsiCo and Kraft Foods and Kellogg's and Post and all these. multinational corporations that want to use aspartame or artificial sweeteners in their products because it's what the public wants. Now, I've reported on aspartame in the past, and I thought, well, we haven't done that for a long time. Let's take an updated look at aspartame and see if there's very much that has changed over the years. First, let's take a look at a brief history of the international sugar trade. The reason that people want artificial sweetener is because most people know or understand that sugar is bad for our health, especially the sugar that is refined sugar. You know, the white sugar, CNH, pure corn, or pure cane sugar from Hawaii, they used to call it. Now we use a lot of high fructose corn syrup as sweetener. If you'll look on the ingredients label of almost any packaged food that you buy, you'll find some form of sugar or sweetener in there. And because people's concern about the use of this manufactured sugar has been so high over the years, when the manufacturers of this artificial sugar came out and said, hey, listen, you want to eliminate sugar in your diet, we got just the thing for you. And it took off like a shot. Well, there have been numerous studies and counter studies and arguments concerning this artificial sweetener from the time that it was first released and put into the food supply. And of course, most of it's bad press. The good press comes from the manufacturers who have a financial interest in the manufacture and the sale of their product. And you can readily understand why they would want to be front and center with telling you that this stuff is really good for you, because it eliminates sugar, which we all know is bad for us. Well, a history of sugar and the sugar trade begins like this. So whether in cubes dropped in your cups of coffee or in 100-pound sacks, Grandma had in the pantry for her cakes, pies, jellies, jams, or unseen in the soda pop, ice cream, processed breakfast cereals, and candy. Refined sugar has been a mainstay of the civilized diet for many centuries. Only recently have sugar, and now artificial sweeteners, have consumers become aware of health risks that are associated with the consumption of these two products. But contemporary health concerns come centuries after the sweet story first began. The international sugar trade is a story of slavery, slaves planted and harvested the canes, and addicted people became slaves to their sweetness. Now, following is a brief look into the history of the sweet slavery. Understanding how 300 years of refined sugar commerce has shaped history will give us a much clearer understanding of the economics and the politics of today's synthetic sweetener marketplace. Well, way back in the beginning, for thousands of years, refined forms of sugar were totally unknown to man. From the Garden of Eden up to the New Testament times and the Koran, there is not a single mention of what we now know as sugar. Ancient Chinese medical texts make absolutely no reference to sugar at all. And the ancient Greeks did not even have a word for sugar. But as early as 325 BC, Admiral Narses, sailing in the service of Alexander the Great, described a peculiar kind of honey that comes from canes. Peoples native to where sugar cane grows would press the cane and drink its sweet juice, or simply cut it into bite-sized pieces and chew it up and take the juice from the sweet cane. And although the juice from the cane would not keep, however, it would quickly ferment. Now, William Duffy, in his classic number one bestseller called Sugar Blues, first published back in 1975, identified the technological development that marked the beginning of the international sugar trade that we now call the sweet slavery. The School of Medicine and Pharmacology at the University of Jandishpur, with a pride of the Persian Empire, is credited with the research and development of a process for solidifying and refining the juice of the cane into solid form that would last without fermenting. Today we call that white sugar. Transportation and trade were now possible. Now, this happened sometime prior to 600 AD when the Persians began growing the sweet sugar cane on their own. Now we'll take a look at the fall of the Arab Empire. Now, the Persians began exporting loaves of stone honey, or saccharum, to the Orient. When the Persian Empire was overrun by the armies of Islam and fell in the 9th century AD, the Arabs took control of the saccharum trade. The Arab world discovered sugared food, sugared drinks, and fermented sugar beverages. The Arab world was also the first discoverer of many new diseases. And Duffy believes sugar played a key role in the decline of the Arab Empire. He interprets the notes of German botanist Leonhard Ruwolf as indicating he viewed the sugar addiction of the Sultan's armies in the same light modern observers viewed American forces in Vietnam who became addicted to heroin. The sugar-addicted Turks and Moors are no longer the intrepid fighters that they had formerly been, Ruwolf observed. Similarly, a Japanese philosopher told Duffy in 1965, "If you really expect to conquer the North Vietnamese, you must drop Army PXs on them, sugar, candy, and Coca-Cola. That will destroy them faster than bombs." Europeans wrestled for control of the sugar trade, and the European sugar trade was largely controlled by the Portuguese by the mid-1400s. But the Spaniards were yapping at their heels, and the Portuguese captured Negroes from the West African coast and set them to slavery on sugarcane plantations in Valencia and Granada. In 1510, the Portuguese had expanded their sugar production to South America and were importing Negro slave labor to grow and harvest sugarcane in Brazil. Rather than keep lawbreakers imprisoned at home, they shipped prisoners to the New World, where they were encouraged to breed with natives and produce half-breeds capable of working the sugarcane plantations. The Spaniards, following Christopher Columbus, had exterminated the natives in the West Indies by 1596, by way of a decree in 1555 by Emperor Charles V, and then they brought in African slaves to work their fields of cane. Sugar profits were largely responsible for the rise of the Spanish and Portuguese empires. Sugar addiction and the diseases and immorality that accompany it was also arguably a contributing factor in their fall. British and Dutch interests had control of the West Indies sugar production by about 1650. During this era, the rum trade began to flourish, and enough rum was being imported into the American colonies for the annual consumption of every man, woman, and child to be about 4 gallons. ships loaded with rum were exchanged for blacks who were traded to British plantation owners in the West Indies in trade for molasses that was sold to rum makers in the colonies to satisfy the colonists' growing thirst for distilled spirits. Rum was also being traded to Indians for furs at tremendous profit to the white traders and at tremendous social and economic loss to the Indians. Now, in 1860, the census population of Negro slaves in the United States was about 4.5 million. It is estimated that some 20 million Negroes survived the voyage to become slaves in the Western world. It will be no exaggeration to put the tale and toll of the slave trade at 20 million Africans, of which two-thirds are to be charged against sugar, wrote British historian Noel Deere in his book The History of Sugar, published in 1949. Planting, tending, and harvesting sugarcane is back-breaking work performed in the hot, humid climates that cane prefers to grow in. Negroes were the only human race able to survive under that yoke of sweet servitude. And according to Deere, it took some 13.2 million Negro slaves to produce enough raw sugarcane to satisfy the Western world's sweet tooth demand. By the 1800s, France and Great Britain were wrestling for control of the international sugar trade. No cask of sugar arrives in Europe to which blood is not sticking. In view of the misery of these slaves, anyone with feelings should renounce these wares and refuse the enjoyment of what is only to be bought with tears and death of countless unhappy creatures, wrote French philosopher Claude Adrien in the 1850s. While his nation was profiting immensely from this sugar trade. Then, on the eve of the American Civil War, sugar and slavery were as solidly linked together as two sides of the same coin. Now, England was so addicted to sugar as a substance and as a commodity of unparalleled profitability that it amended its Navigation Act in 1660. American colonists were banned from trading sugar, indigo, and tobacco with any other country except England, Ireland, or another British colony. In 1664, the Acts were again amended, so British colonies could only receive foreign goods by way of England. The Boston Tea Party in 1773 was a colonial response to these British Navigation Acts. Well, when sugar was first introduced to Great Britain in the 1300s, only the highest of the upper class could afford this exotic treat. By the mid-1600s, the nation was importing 16 million pounds of sugar annually, 20 million pounds by 1700. And by 1800, the British were consuming more than 160 million pounds of sugar, 72 pounds for every man, woman, and child in the entire country. It was about the same time that the British Empire began to crumble and disintegrate. Now, according to Dr. Nancy Appleton, the author of Lick the Sugar Habit, the United States Department of Agriculture reported that between 1970 and 1995, Americans increased their sugar and corn sweetener consumption by about 22%. And the USDA reported in 2000 that Americans consume nearly 22 million tons, that's about 151 pounds for each man, woman, and child, of sugar and corn, corn glucose, and dextrose sweeteners in 1999. Americans derive about 40% of their carbohydrate intake from sugar. Since 1984, Americans have gotten in the habit of drinking more soda pop than water. The number of 12-ounce cans of soda pop produced in 1997 was 580 cans per person, or about 1.5 cans a day for every man, woman, and child in the country. Now that figure, a figure that has doubled since 1974. So think about that. From 1974 to 1997, the consumption of soda pop doubled. Sevenfold since 1942. And 12 ounces of soda pop contain 9 teaspoons of sugar, about 40 grams. Now, the myth of sugar substitutes. The main argument in support of providing non-caloric sugar substitutes for the sweet tooth consumer is to diminish their intake of the real thing, the real sugar. Health officials have determined that America's addiction to sugar causes obesity, tooth decay, diabetes, heart disease, and behavioral problems. Sugar consumption in the United States, in the country, continues to increase regardless of the marketplace presence of sugar substitutes, such as aspartame, which itself has skyrocketed in popularity since 1982. Now, we are also experiencing in this country epidemics of chronic ailments historically associated with sugar addiction. The problem appears to be compounded by the world's new addiction to aspartame. So, in conclusion, our self-destructive demand for sweets has been shaping human history for many, many centuries. So it's a political problem, or a political question as well. In fact, here in this country, there are monopolies and cartels of sugar companies that have a priority in the pricing process that is determined by Congress and the Food and Drug Administration, just like peanuts. So it's big business for big businesses. And, of course, it's supported by the population as a whole. We have a huge demand for sugar. We need sugar in our food, sugar in our coffee, sugar in our candy. I mean, we are sugarholics, and by God, we're going to have our sugar. Now, over the years, we've come to the new knowledge that this sugar causes tooth decay and a whole host and plethora of health problems. And so some enterprising fellow come up and said, well, how could we have a sweetener that is just a chemical that doesn't have any calories, so from that point of view we won't gain weight, and it doesn't have the health effects that sugar poses. And Viola, they came up with a new program here. It's chemistry in action. They came up with these artificial sweeteners. And aspartame was first developed by the Searle Company back in the 1970s. And it's about 100 times sweeter than sugar. I mean, that stuff is sweet, sweet. And it was natural. And so by 1981, the powers that be, mainly Monsanto, and the Food and Drug Administration got the stuff licensed and passed and approved. And so now it's in just about everything that you can imagine in the marketplace. If it says light on the package, you can just about bet that it's got some form of artificial sweetener in it. Now, how does this aspartame cause damage in your body? If in fact it does. When a matter is in controversy, the fair and civilized manner of solving the question is allowing both parties of a dispute to bring their evidence before an impartial body. once both sides have presented their evidence, the impartial body is adequately prepared to settle the matter based upon those facts. Now, were such a forum used to determine the safety of aspartame, the substance would probably no longer be an item of controversy, and it would probably no longer be poisoning a trusting public. Now, prior to and since its 1981 FDA approval, an international who's who of scientific minds have been producing peer-reviewable reports warning against the dietary use of aspartame. Now, to my knowledge, not one of these studies has been duplicated and scientifically determined to be in error. Well, what this means is that until now, peer-reviewable science has published to the contrary, aspartame is linked to the FDA's list of 92 reported symptoms. It also means that anyone who consumes aspartame is a candidate for a broad spectrum of psychological and physiological complications that include blindness, insanity, and death. But there will be no new credible peer-reviewable science to reveal that aspartame is safe. There wasn't any reviewed material in 1965, 1981, 1983, or 85, and there hasn't been any at any time since then. And if you take a look at the aspartame point-counterpoint on page 7 and 8, you're going to see that published science and field experience easily refute claims promoting the safety of aspartame. Now, the argument in support of aspartame approval is, aspartame developer Searle Company conducted studies that are difficult to find and impossible to duplicate because they were scientifically flawed. Manipulated data were used to arrive at preconceived conclusions. And based upon these studies, for which Searle has been or was being investigated for fraud, aspartame was initially approved by the FDA for use in dry foods only. And as of 1993, it has been approved for use in any product consumed by people living in the United States. European Union officials reportedly approved the use of aspartame and labeling requirements for recommended or per recommendation of the Food and Drug Administration, the World Health Organization, and the American Medical Association. So the argument in opposition to aspartame approval, this section will take a little work on our part. The lay people, to understand, brilliant men and women have independently performed studies, largely at their own expense and personal sacrifice, to save your life and the lives of those close to you. So please honor their commitment to your health by reading this article with a dictionary close to you, if need be. Let me make an editorial comment here. The point-counterpoint argument, that is, here's what the FDA tells you, and here's what independent studies show. When we take a look at these studies, we find that studies that have been accepted and approved by the Food and Drug Administration are many, and they're approved, and they're bandied about, and they're held up in front of us, and they say, now look at this study, and it shows us conclusively that aspartame is safe. And then when we ask, well, who did those studies, we find that, it was Monsanto, or it was some of the multinational corporations that are making and producing and then selling the product. And shouldn't we ask then, well, isn't there some kind of a conflict of interest here? Now, on the other hand, the people that are opposed to aspartame don't have a financial interest in the manufacture and sale of it, so we should ask, well, then why are you opposed to it? What do you care about it? Well, I'm one of those, and I'm taking my time, my effort, and my energy to make this report, and I'm not getting paid anything for it, so I'm not making a profit by bringing you this report on aspartame. So, I'm opposed to aspartame, and I'm opposed to it because of the studies that I've seen. Now, that's my conclusion. And so, what I want to do is to bring the information to your mind so that you can make an intelligent decision for yourself. Because whether you consume aspartame or not, it's no skin off my back one way or the other. I don't care if you eat the stuff or not. I don't get paid a dime for promoting it, and I don't get a dime for knocking it. And so I'm one of the guys that can claim that I'm totally neutral. I don't care one way or the other. I'm opposed to it based upon what I've seen. So I'm going to tell you that in advance, that I'm not promoting it to any degree. And then I'm knocking it as much as possible. And I'm claiming to be neutral. And that's because I'm not being paid by either side to make my observations or to make my report. And I'm suspicious of people that get paid. You know, once you're getting paid, for instance, we've got an ad circulating here against one of our congressmen, Roy Blunt. And the ad that's knocking Blunt says, Roy Blunt voted against some bills that were important to the petroleum industry, and that Congressman Blunt is accepting money from the petroleum industry or certain oil companies. Well, you know, that just makes all the sense in the world. If I was a congressman and I was accepting millions of dollars in campaign contributions from Exxon, I think that I would understand clearly that if I voted against legislation that affected Exxon, they probably wouldn't give me any more campaign contributions. So if I want to keep those campaign contributions rolling in, I should then vote the way that Exxon would like to see me vote in order to keep me on their team and keep them sending campaign contributions into my coffers. I think that makes all the sense in the world, and that's why I've come to the conclusion that campaign contributions are, in effect, bribes. And it's just that we don't want to call them bribes because that's a bad term, and so we want to have a good label to put on it. It's like queer. We don't want to call people queer, so we call them gay. Well, okay. So we don't want to call these bribes, so we call them campaign contributions. It just kind of makes it more politically correct, doesn't it? Now, we're going to see here in a few minutes that when we get into this point-counterpoint argument over here, that companies like Monsanto and Searle and others that manufacture this have a vested interest in bribing the politicians and the bureaucracy and paying them campaign contributions and giving them jobs in the industry after they leave government, for the express purpose of selling more aspartame, irrespective of whether that's good for you or safe for you, or if it's the right thing, ethical thing, or isn't. Hey, we're at the halfway point here, so let me give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on Compact Disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there off of our website. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the aspartame update, talking about how aspartame causes damage to your body. Aspartame, as of 1995, aspartame accounted for 75% of adverse reactions reported to the FDA. Aspartame is comprised of 40% aspartic acid and 50% phenylalanine and 10% methanol. Some of the metabolites of aspartame are methanol, formaldehyde, formic acid, and a substance called DKT. The body protects the brain from chemical imbalances through the blood-brain barrier, known as the BBB. However, the BBB, the blood-brain barrier, matures during childhood and is compromised by ill health and often allows substances to pass while functioning properly. The first chemical, aspartic acid, the body produces aspartic acid that serves as a neurotransmitter, facilitating the transition of information from neuron to neuron. If there is an excess in aspartic acid, which is known as an amino acid, it creates too many neurotransmitters in certain areas of the brain. This excess damages or kills neurons by overstimulating them, hence the term an excitotoxin. Excessive amounts of aspartate over time begin to destroy the neurons, and significant populations of people who consume aspartame develop a variety of symptomologies commonly diagnosed as multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and Lou Gehrig's disease. Undiagnosed aspartame users commonly experience memory loss, sexual dysfunction, blindness, heart irregularities, headache, loss of hearing, seizures, blood sugar anomalies, irritability, and varying degrees of dementia. Naturally, populations most vulnerable to excitotoxic neurological damage are infants and developing children, pregnant women, and the elderly and the chronically ill. The second chemical, phenylalanine is also an amino acid produced in the body. Phenylalanine from aspartame can cross the BBB, the blood-brain barrier, and cause an imbalance of it in the brain, causing serotonin to decrease. This leads to emotional disorders. Elevated phenylalanine levels have been seen in the blood and in areas of the brain of human subjects who chronically use aspartame. Dr. Louis Elsas showed Congress that such levels are dangerous to fetuses and infants, and he also showed that lab rats metabolize phenylalanine more efficiently than do humans. I'm going to stop there and repeat that. He also showed that laboratory rats could metabolize this phenylalanine much more efficiently than human beings do. And that becomes important because many of these tests and studies are done with laboratory mice and rats. Neurosurgeon Russell Blaylock showed earlier in studies indicating concentrations of phenylalanine accumulate in the hypothalamus, medulla oblongata, and corpus stranium areas of the brain. Previous science has determined that phenylalanine buildup in the brain can cause schizophrenia or increase susceptibility to seizures. Can we infer, then, that aspartame use is partially responsible for increased sales of Prozac and other psychotropic drugs? The third element in aspartame is called methanol. Methanol is a well-known neurotoxin. The EPA recognizes methanol as a cumulative poison, and that methanol is oxidized to formaldehyde and formic acid. Both of these metabolites are toxic. Methanol is slowly released in the small intestine when aspartame encounters the enzyme chymotrypsin. Methanol metabolizes faster as free methanol, which is created when aspartame is heated above 86 degrees Fahrenheit. In 1993, the Food and Drug Administration approved the use of aspartame in a wide variety of food items that would always be heated above 86 degrees Fahrenheit. The symptoms of methanol poisoning include headaches, tinnitus, dizziness, nausea, digestive disturbances, weakness, vertigo, chills, vision problems, retinal damage, and blindness, memory lapses, numbness, shooting pains, and behavioral problems and neuritis. Human beings lacking a couple of key enzymes are many times more sensitive to the toxic effects of methanol than are other animals. Therefore, animal studies with regard to the effects of methanol in the body are of little, if any, value. Aspartame enthusiasts are quick to mention that many common foods such as fruit juices and alcoholic beverages contain methanol. However, in these instances, ethanol is always present, usually in higher amounts, ethanol serves as an antidote to methanol. Aspartame contains no ethanol. Now let's look at formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is a known carcinogen. It causes retinal damage, it interferes with DNA and the replication of DNA, and it is known to cause birth defects. Now there's an element here called DKP, a byproduct of aspartame metabolism. DKP has been associated with the formation of brain tumors. DKP has been found to form in aspartame containing beverages during prolonged storage, particularly above 86 degrees Fahrenheit. Back in the early 1990s, Gulf War troops drank copious amounts of aspartame sweetened sodas that had been stored for extended periods in the hot Arabian sun. Conclusions, then. Science has shown how the components of aspartame are metabolized in the body. Aspartame's three main ingredients are themselves problematic. The breakdown into substances already known to be toxic to the human body. Tests conducted by Searle to support claims that aspartame is safe do not withstand peer review, and the company was being investigated for fraud prior to aspartame being approved by the FDA for use in foods and beverages. Let me give you a little analogy here concerning these animals and animal studies. In the Bible, there's a statement made in Leviticus 3, verse 17. It says, "You shall eat no manner of fat." So human beings are told by their Creator, don't eat animal fat. Over the years, we have had an opportunity to take a look at what this fat does, and it builds up in your arteries through cholesterol, plugs them up, and you end up like Bill Clinton by needing quadruple bypass surgery. That's because the fat plugs up your arteries. Now, let's suppose for the sake of our discussion here, we wanted to run some animal tests to see whether or not fat was good for human beings and should be incorporated into the snack foods that we all eat out of the concession vending machines. So, we go out and we incorporate a company, and, you know, we can call it the fat enterprise company, and we take a bunch of dogs in there and we start feeding these dogs copious amounts of fat, and we start looking for decreases, you know, in their vital signs, or we look for the health effects that this fat is having on these dogs. And what we find is that the dogs thrive on fat. Their coats get sleek, and they're just as healthy as pigs in the barnyard. And so we write up a report and file it with the FDA, and we tell the FDA fat is good for human beings because in animal studies, the animals just got fat and their hair was, and their coats were slick, and there were no adverse health effects. What's wrong with that kind of study? Well, here's what's wrong with it. Dogs have great amounts of hydrochloric acid in their stomachs, and dogs can digest fat that human beings cannot digest. So when human beings eat fat, especially over a long period of time, they become debilitated, and they ultimately have cardiovascular disease, heart attacks and strokes. Now we call that cholesterol, good cholesterol, bad cholesterol, plugged up atherosclerosis and arteriosclerosis and so on. the reason that the animal study is poor is because dogs are designed by God to eat fat, and they get fat and they get healthy on it, and human beings aren't. And that's why he said to us, you know, you shall eat no manner of fat. Now, what happened here with Monsanto was that Monsanto went out and they took a bunch of lab rats and they fed them this aspartame. And as it turns out, rodents can digest methanol and this ascorbic acid. Humans can't, and these lab rats can. So in their study, they said, well, see, we fed it to these lab animals, and they just got fat and happy. And it was a very successful study, and therefore it's good for human beings. Then they went out and licensed it and gave it to human beings. Then we started taking a look at, well, what happened to the human beings that were eating it? And they developed 92 symptoms. And as we progress along here, I'm going to take these 92 symptoms, and I'll show them to you, in the various parts of your body, such as your eyes and ears and your neurologic system and your gastrointestinal system and the skin and allergies and menstrual changes and things like that. They don't kill people in every instance. Sometimes it kills people, but not every time. In many cases, it just gives you a symptom. I was watching TV the other night, and this lady was being interviewed, and she had fibromyalgia. And she went to her doctor, and then the doctor said, well, we don't know what causes fibromyalgia, but we've got a treatment for it, and you're going to be disabled for the rest of your life, so just make up your mind to that. And so now here's this lady. She's in chronic pain, and that's what fibromyalgia does. And I don't know where you hurt. Maybe it's in all of your joints all over your body. And this lady, she's got fibromyalgia. She went down to Social Security, got total disability, and so she's retired now. She's 42 years old, and she's retired on Social Security disability with fibromyalgia, which is an incurable disease. All right. Now, as it turns out, fibromyalgia is a disease caused by this aspartame poisoning. Fibromyalgia. And I'll show you that as we progress along. If this lady would stop eating aspartame, then her joints would ease up and she would experience less pain and then pretty soon no pain, and then she could get off of disability. And you see, I'm not sure this lady wants to get off of disability. Down here in the Ozarks where I am, the highest status that a person can achieve here, I mean something that everybody has looked up to, like a doctor or an airline pilot or a ship's captain. And when you are retired on total Social Security disability, you've got the same status down here where I live, near Dogpatch, USA, as an airline pilot, a ship's captain, you know, a doctor, somebody that is somebody. This is something that everybody wants, they desire. All right, let's take a look here at this methanol then, or the conclusion. You know, science has shown how the components of aspartame are metabolized in the body. Aspartame's three main ingredients are themselves problematic, and they break down into substances already known to be toxic to the human body. Tests conducted by Searle to support claims that aspartame is safe do not withstand peer review, and the company was being investigated for fraud prior to aspartame being approved by the FDA for use in foods and beverages. This DKP formaldehyde methanol aspartic acid and this phenylalanine are all toxins. Now, they don't kill you just because you can take a little bit of cyanide or a little bit of some other toxic material, you know, and it won't kill you. It doesn't make you work any better, but it isn't going to kill you. And then over time, these poisons can build up in your body, and they can cause debilitating diseases. Now, there's a fellow by the name of Michael J. Fox. And he goes around and he's legislating for, he's out here trying to sell the concept or the idea that Congress should fund more tax dollars to finding a cure to Parkinson's disease. And I think he's been diagnosed with Parkinson's. Parkinson's disease is one of the symptoms that comes from aspartame poisoning. And so Michael J. Fox is out here promoting a cure for Parkinson's disease. And we need some kind of a drug, you know, some kind of a patentable product over here that we can sell and make money to cure Parkinson's disease. And the poor guy, he's shaking all the time. And I'm sure he's sincere, but did you know that he is also an advertising spokesman for Diet Pepsi? And this guy drinks Diet Pepsi, and he's addicted to it, and he drinks a lot of it, from the reports that I see. And so the poison, that is the aspartame poison in the Diet Pepsi, for which the Pepsi-Cola company is paying Michael J. Fox to promote, has given him Parkinson's disease, for which now he's out campaigning for taxpayers to find a cure to Parkinson's disease. Well, we're not going to find a cure to Parkinson's disease until we quit drinking the soda pop that's laced with the poison. But that's what they're looking for, and that's what they're trying to sell you on. Now, I personally am not opposed to Mr. Fox drinking Diet Pepsi. If that's what he wants to do, that's his choice. I think somebody should inform him, and I find it hard to believe that Michael J. Fox is a dummy. Or a dumbbell. He may be ignorant, I don't know. But I'm just a crummy plumber, and what I've been reading to you here about aspartame is available on the internet. I mean, hell, you can just do an aspartame search on Google or Yahoo, anybody, and then I think you'll get plenty of information relevant and relative to this aspartame over here so that you can see both sides of the issue, and then you can come to a conclusion. That's what I did. I came to a conclusion. I said, hey, this stuff's pretty poor. And I'm not going to drink it. I avoid it like AIDS, herpes, and VD. I read labels, and when I see something that's labeled sweet and low or light, I avoid it. I don't buy it. Now, the average Joe Sixpack who hasn't been informed or doesn't know, and that may be you, and when you see something that's light or something that's sweet and low, you say to yourself, well, that's what I want because I'm overweight and I don't want to consume a lot of sugar, so I want to avoid that. I'm on a diet. Well, come to find out that this aspartame makes you gain weight. That's a fact. The aspartame here makes you actually gain weight. So it's not a diet item at all. If you want to gain weight, you want to eat more aspartame. That'll help you do that. All right, boys and girls, I'm out of time. I've covered that much material for this session. Let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public.